time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today. Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true.
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy, it's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Brewski, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
We're digging into the heart of another case that we've been covering for many a years, one of the biggest injustices that I think we've seen, Richard Allen and the Delphi case, one of the most contested criminal convictions in recent history. The state of Indiana versus Richard Allen, the man sentenced to 130 years for the Delphi murders. Beyond the headlines, it was a story that raises serious legal and ethical red flags. Jailhouse calls made after months in solitary, psychiatric deterioration ignored, and a confession, if you can even call it that, ordered in the middle of a mental health collapse. The man who's been here for all of it, and in the courtroom, the very secretive courtroom that no one could get into while the trial was actually going on, Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, joining us. I know there's some activity going on in the world of appeals. I want to start there. I looked at some of the documents that you've posted, and my head's already spinning because I'm not a defense attorney. So, could you enlighten Please. Us a little bit on what the hell is going on? What's the latest now in this case in terms of where things are going?
Yeah. So where we're at right now is basically in the beginning stages of the appellate process. So anytime somebody's convicted for a crime and they have intent on appealing, first thing that has to be done in the process is, you know, and I'm not counting anything that might need to be filed at the trial court level before you can file your notice of appeal. I'm talking after a notice of appeal, mm-hmm. which is just that. Like a notice of appeal is just saying to the appellate court, hey, we're going to be filing an appeal. Here's our notice to protect us under the statute. So we're not yeah. waiving anything. So that was done. And then the next thing that they have to do is they have to put the record together. Mm-hmm. The record's everything. So that's the trial transcripts, it's all the exhibits, because that is what the appellate court uses to see what happened down below. Mm-hmm. Not just during the trial, but also during the pretrial phase. So during all the motions that were being denied without hearing over and over and over. All of those things are going to be raised during the appeal. So that takes quite a while. Mm-hmm. And then once the record is certified, meaning they've got it put together and they're saying, okay, here you go, appellate court, here's a certified record. That step is then completed. Now here it's been completed. They have a certified record. So at that point, the onus then shifts onto the appellant, which in this case is Richard Allen and his mm-hmm. attorneys. And they have to get their brief filed. So what we've seen over the past, I think, 3 months now is Allen's attorneys have needed to get extensions for various reasons, most of which seem to be dealing with some of the exhibits don't appear to be in the record.
Okay.
Now, if you followed the case at all, if you haven't, in the Richard Allen case, also known as the Delphi case, there was a huge filing pretty early on in that case, and it was something called a Franks memo.
Mm-hmm.
And a Franks memo, or a Franks, a motion for a Franks hearing, is essentially saying, just the real nuts and bolts kind of definition of it, that law enforcement went in front of a judge and either lied or misstated or omitted something that may have affected the judge's decision as to whether or not to issue a warrant. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, one of the attorneys, Andy Baldwin, had filed this 136-page Frank's memo. I had never seen anything like it. It had, it reads like a kind of a fantasy novel. It's insane. Mm-hmm. I know, Tony, you've covered it, but it's, you know, it's got Odinists and, mm-hmm. you know, marauding bands of Odinists, you know, kidnapping girls and, you know, white supremacists. And it's got all this stuff. It's, you know, it's got the sticks and the runes and everything. It's unlike anything that I've ever seen in terms of a legal filing. So at any rate, when they filed that 136-page document, along with that was a ton of exhibits, okay? The exhibits are what are at issue right now. So Rick Allen's attorneys are saying, hey, obviously the Franks memorandum and the repeated request for a hearing over the course of a year, and that being denied, and rulings in that Franks, when they finally did get a hearing on it, and her rulings with regard to the third-party culprit stuff, it was contained within the Franks. We need to litigate that. And in order to fully litigate it, we have to make sure that the appellate court has all the exhibits. So this is where the problem is right now. And usually when I'm an Illinois attorney, I've got a lot of attorneys that I know very well and I trust implicitly in Indiana. And one of them is a lawyer named Karen Winicky. She's an appellate lawyer, criminal appellate lawyer out there. And, you know, she kind of knows, because every jurisdiction's different, you mm-hmm. know, like Arkansas is going to be different than Illinois. Illinois is going to be different than Massachusetts. You know, every jurisdiction has their own rules. So what I kind of like to do, I think what might be helpful if I can figure out where it is, if you don't mind, mm-hmm. I kind of like, if you don't have it, I'd like to throw up the most recent court order that came down. Let me see if I can share it. Let me see if I can figure out which window it's in. This might be tougher than anticipated. Let me see.
On your ex?
Yeah, you know what? I'll pull up Kara's page because she's okay. Got it right there. All right. So this is the order that came down on October 3rd. Okay. Mm-hmm. And this kind of gives us a little bit of idea of where the appellate court's at the mm-hmm. present time. And it says the appellant has filed a verified motion to compel transmission of exhibits and asking for a new due date. The appellant states the transcript does not include certain exhibits, specifically the exhibits filed with the appellant's September 18th, 2023 motion for Frank's hearing and exhibits 3A and 3B that were filed with the appellant's January 20th, 2025 motion to correct error. So that the motion to correct error, just so people understand, was filed post-conviction.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, in Illinois, before you file for an appeal after your client is convicted, we have to file a motion for a new trial. It's a mandatory step that we have to take before we file our notice of appeal. In Indiana, they don't have that step. In Indiana, they have the option of filing a motion to correct errors. I think, Tony, you and I covered that pretty thoroughly on one of our episodes together. There was some kind of mind-blowing stuff in there, a lot of new information that came out. And so that thing was filed, and that particular thing carried a lot of new evidence, but it also was essentially saying, look, all these things went wrong before and during the trial.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'd like to get a new trial. You know, it, obviously you knew Gull was not going to grant it, but it was important to make the record. So
yeah,
that's what they end up doing. So, and then in that, there was also a ton of exhibits that were filed. Okay. So the, and here's where it gets sticky. So these exhibits were not offered or admitted during a trial or a hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So like if I'm at trial and say, for instance, I have a piece of evidence that I want to get in and I forget during my case in chief, which it happens. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, lawyers have a lot of moving parts during a trial and, you know, on a case, and we're all human beings. And on occasion, sometimes an exhibit, you'll forget to get it entered. You'll, you know, you have to get it on the record and entered for it to be a part of the record. Now, I'm not saying that's what happened here, or maybe it did. I don't know. Whatever the case may be, the exhibits that were attached to the Franks memo were not entered into evidence, okay? Which means that they're not going to be showing up in the docket, okay? Mm-hmm. So that's where the problem is. So thus, they're not a part of the transcript. However, these exhibits are part of the clerk's record, okay? So when Andy filed it, and I know he filed, and I'm talking about Andrew Baldwin, one of the attorneys, he filed the memo itself electronically. I don't know if they attached the exhibits electronically or if they went in and hand delivered the exhibits because they're voluminous.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I tend to think that they may have brought them in, but it does say that they are part of the clerk's record. So the clerk's acknowledging that they have them and that they were filed, but they weren't filed during a hearing or a trial. So it's different when you're filing with the circuit clerk. It's different than filing with the court clerk and getting it entered as evidence. They're two different things. So the order then says, look, all right, go over to appellate rule 2E. And as such, the exhibit should be provided in the appellant's appendix. Okay. And then they cite the rule, appellate rule 50B. And then they make this ruling. So having reviewed the matter, the court finds and orders as follows. One, that the appellant's verified motion to compel transmission of exhibits and new date is granted in part as a final extension, meaning, okay, we're granting this kind of because we're saying that we're telling you, look, those exhibits weren't in the transcript, which means it's not in the record that they received the certified record. However, we do see that it is a part of the clerk's record. Therefore, you can get it in front of us through your appendix when you file your brief. Okay. So because an appellate brief is a very lengthy document, you have a table of cases with all the cases you cite. And then eventually you have an appendix that's going to contain all your exhibits and other things as well.
Okay.
So they're saying that that's where it should be. Did you have a question?
No. I mean, I'm trying to follow along as best I can and connect the dots.
It's a lot.
Because I guess my translation would be it's a bunch of bureaucratic bullshit that really, I mean, I get there's purpose to it, but come on, for the love of God, there's got to be clearer ways of handling these things than the way we do.
I mean, you're thinking way too commonsensically. I mean,
no.
That's the law, Tony, come on.
I know.
Sense when it comes to the courts, Tony, you know better than that.
Let's make it 50 hoops of fire.
Yeah. And you know, with glass under your feet.
Yes.
So they're kind of granting it, but they're not. And they are granting the final extension. So they're calling it a final extension.
Okay.
Okay. And that's problematic because the appellant, so they're now, and then they go on to say in number two that the appellant's brief is due on October 21st, which is coming around the corner very, very quickly. Here's the problem from the appellate attorney's perspective is that when you're writing the brief, they are the ones that don't have it either. So not only does the appellate court, who doesn't have anything in front of them of substance yet, they don't have it, but more importantly, at this point, the appellate attorneys for Richard Allen don't have it. Now, again, Tony, you're probably sitting there thinking, well, why the fuck don't they just call Andy Baldwin and say, hey, man, can you send me over all the exhibits that you put in with the Franks memo? And then that would solve the problem in terms of them being able to start preparing that portion of their brief with regards, you know, and I mean, I'm assuming that that's taking place. I don't know what's happening with that part of it. All right. Like, I don't know if they still don't have it when they're filing a motion to compel a transmission of exhibits. That tells me that they still don't have it. You know what I'm saying? So
is it time for Richard Allen to get new attorneys?
There's a good question.
At this point, the trial attorneys have no hand in this. This is
I know. But if we're going to trace some of these problems back in time, and I get people are human and all this, but thank God that they stood up and they wanted to do this pro bono. And I know they went through hell, and I applaud them for all that. But I mean, if this is the issue, and they're not giving that to the appellate attorney, I don't know what the excuse is. I mean, we're literally talking like literally. Okay, can we have that? Is this? I mean, does it have to be securely sent in some sort of fashion? Can it be a PDF that they email over? Is it literally click send? What are we talking about?
Oddly enough, I'm having Andy Baldwin on my channel tonight, and I'm going to ask him flat out. Yeah. And Andy's never one to shy away.
I've seen him on you before. I respect him. Yeah, I want to know what the hell's going on.
Right. What we want to know is what's the fix.
Yes.
Like, how do we repair this so that everybody has what they can have, so we can just have a straight up appeal filed without any of the bullshit and let the appellate courts decide where this thing lands?
Because, right? Look, they got a track record of bullshit with them, and it's not necessarily always on them. I mean, things getting stolen from the office and all that shit that made everything. It's like some people can be kind of clustery. I don't know that I don't know, but it's like there's a pattern. There's a pattern. Let's not make this the norm, I guess, is the point.
100%. So Kara Winicky, just to kind of finish off that court order, and again, she's an Indiana appellate attorney. She says, read the order carefully. It does not compel the trial court clerk to provide the exhibits to appellate counsel. Instead, it says that the exhibit should be included in the appellant's appendix as they are part of the record. The trial clerk should have a copy of those exhibits to provide to counsel.
Should.
Exactly.
Should and does are two different things.
Exactly. So, and then she goes on to say, but if she does not have a copy, talking about the clerk, the counsel may need to file a motion to stay or stop or halt or, you know, pause the proceedings and recreate the missing portion of the record. Appellate Rule 32 lays out the process. Now, we're not going to torture our viewers here by digging into that. I mean, the bottom line that you're seeing is it's a clusterfuck. Yeah. Everything that's gone on with this particular case in Richard Allen's life has been a clusterfuck since the date of arrest. And, you know, I mean, this is his first shot at getting a new trial. You know, it's always your direct appeal. And, you know, depending on who you ask, some think that he has an excellent shot at the appellate level to get it. Others don't. Others think it's going to come from post-conviction, which is a whole different can of worms. And that's a thing where I am of the mindset, along with some other attorneys in Indiana, that investigation should be underway now. Because of the age of the case, because you have witnesses that are aging and memories that are fading, and this thing is 8 years in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you wait through the appellate process, you could be tacking on another 6 months to a year. And then you're talking about starting the post-conviction investigation basically from scratch. Okay. And just so you understand the difference between post-conviction work and direct appeals, is direct appeals deal with issues at the trial court level and are only limited to what happened in pretrial hearings and the trial. Okay. Yeah. So it is not the place for you to bring up newly discovered evidence. So if you uncovered something after the trial, you can't run in your appeal and say, oh, Richard Allen needs a new fucking trial because we uncovered who really did it. They wouldn't hear it on direct appeal. That comes through a post-conviction petition, okay?
So that's where you would introduce new evidence that you found.
Okay. Exactly. So anything that you're digging up after the fact, or that you dug up post-conviction, or that maybe you dug up prior to the trial finishing, but for whatever reason, trial counsel and the state was not aware of this evidence, and it passes muster as being newly discovered, because that's part of the evaluation. The court will always look, well, was this truly newly discovered, or was this available to the parties prior to trial and they just missed it? If they just missed it, as shitty and hardcore as it sounds, the appellate court's going to see that's on you. You know, we understand that it's a powerful piece of evidence. However, you know, based on what we're seeing, it appears that it was available to you. Y'all just missed it because it was in the discovery or whatever the case may be. Then you have to try to litigate that to see if you can get them to, you know, kind of bend their will and allow it in. So where I'm at with this thing is I would have liked, because starting the post-conviction investigation in no way, shape, or form affects the direct appeal. You know, it's not anything that would hamper the direct appeal at all. And you can be talking to people that you need to be talking to, that, you know, because there were a lot of people on that trail that day.
Yeah.
And what these people saw, if you followed the trial at all through the creators such as myself and Andrea and Lawyer Lee, who were in the courtroom, what became very, very clear is that no two people saw the same thing in terms of the person they were describing. If we were to put up every description of what they're terming bridge guy looked like, every single description is different.
Well, they could have seen different people and been submitting that information.
Are they describing even the same person?
That's my point. Yeah.
That's what Stacey's saying. And it's a great point. And it could be the absolute truth. It could be multiple people that different people are describing. So it's you know, all these people have to be talked to. There's going to be things that were found in the voluminous tips file, which was 15,000 tips came in on this case over the course of 5 years. And some of them are mind blown. You know, some of these tips are like, oh my God, why didn't anybody like look into this shit? Why, you know, people that were saying they were out searching, you know, at the time that the initial search ended, they were still out there, and there's just things out there that have to be fully investigated, you know, because everybody who's of the mindset that Richard Allen, because you can think two things that are kind of inconsistent with one another. You can believe that Richard Allen was railroaded and still not be necessarily sold on the fact that he didn't do this. You can think both of those things and you're fine in thinking that. You know, I think that there's, you know, anybody who's looked at the way that this thing went down and who's being intellectually honest cannot say that this is how the process is supposed to work. From like, not just the pretrial hearings and the way that the judge handled the entire proceeding from beginning through trial, but the fact in how this man was kept. I don't care if you're the biggest monster that's ever walked the face of the earth. We have to have faith that the system is going to work and that person's going to get their just desserts when trial is had and whatever punishment is meted out. That's the system that we've chosen. You can't start throwing people that are innocent until proven guilty, who are pretrial detainees, into a fucking prison for 13 months and have them held in solitary confinement so they lose their mind, start eating their shit, start pounding their head against the fucking wall in order to elicit some kind of confession because you're worried that your case, in terms of the evidence you have, is not strong enough. And well, no one's ever going to convince me. Oh, go ahead, you guys.
Why didn't they just do that in every case? Then the prosecution will always win. The DA will always be right, and you'll drive everyone insane. I mean,
isn't that the slippery slope?
Yeah, I mean, you could do it that way. If we're going to allow it here, then we should allow it for everyone. Everybody who's arrested for any charge, put them in solitary until they confess.
Minor, major, anything. We're just going to start putting you in solitary until eventually you lose your shit. And a guard says, hey, you want to get out of solitary? Just tell us you did it. You say, I did it.
Yep.
That's as simple as problem solved.
Only in America, dreaming in red, white, and blue. Only in America, we'll put you in a cage because we want to. Gull's gonna go over there, put a little stick in your cage and poke. Only in America.
Can I throw something in here?
But before you get something in here, Stacey, can we get that burned onto a CD so I can listen to
it? Oh, it's burned in my head.
I'm going to make you a mixtape. We're going to go back even further.
I'm working on it already, guys.
Fuck the burn. Yeah, we're going to mixtape that shit. Yeah.
So we've had a couple of really good questions in the chat. Help Me Rhonda once said, I'm still hopeful the Innocence Project will get involved in this. What do you think the chances are of that? And could that be a successful route to getting this out in the open?
Yeah, more resources.
Yeah, I think it's very, very high that just understand that most states have multiple innocence projects. Like, so Notre Dame has one in particular. I know for a fact that that Richard Allen's case has been put in front of them. In terms of whether or not they've come on board officially yet, I don't know, but I know that it is on their radar. I'm very much hoping that they're going to pick up the mantle if the direct appeal doesn't work. And again, when you're talking about innocence projects, they're not going to come on and handle the direct appeal.
Right.
That's going to be the post-conviction work. So, yeah, I mean, you want a powerhouse like that because you want to have that kind of gravitas behind you in terms of your reputation. Moving forward and saying, okay, look, if ND's Innocence Project, they're taking it on, we're going to give it some credence because they're not taking on anything that just comes and lands on their desk. They're, they really vet the cases that they're going to look at. So, I mean, that gives it credence right out of the box. And plus, you're just talking about the resources that are available in terms of that kind of entity taking it on. And you really need those types of resources for an investigation like this, because there's just a lot that has to be done. And this case just has so much, because it was cold for 5 years and there was just so much shit out there. I mean, when you go from like all the potential people that were looked at, whether it be Brad Weber, whether it be Ron Logan, whether it be the Holder clan and the Patrick Westfalls and all, there's just a lot of people out there. And Tony, you know that I covered the case heavily, things that I would never report, but the people were in my DMs, dude, like nonstop. And like people like claiming that they knew shit.
Oh my God, I still get it every day. I'm sure you do too. Where it's like, like the weird things that people send you. I mean, you get some dandy. Like there are some that are like, okay, this is maybe some credence here. And some like, did your cat tell you to send you that? Like, is your cat speaking to you? Because I've had some stuff where it's like, look at the pixel here. It's like, it's a pixel.
Yeah. Exactly. But there's one dude in particular who I would not be shocked if he's sending you shit too. He's kind of that guy.
I think we know who we're talking about here.
Yeah,
I blocked him already because he's also the one that claims he wrote the Kim Porter book.
Oh no! I know who that is.
Yeah.
I've had content. No, this guy, he doesn't have any kind of horse in the race in terms of trying to content creator kind of like a grift like that. This guy has been for 2 years with these, I'd say 5,000 word without one bit of punctuation and the entire stream of consciousness fucking like
that's a mental health problem right there.
Oh my God. But everything that I've checked that this guy has ever said in terms of names that he's provided and charges that they've been charged with and connections that these people have, like he is really, really big on that this thing had something to do with a meth ring. I'm not willing to discount that.
Yeah. Maybe he's savant. I mean, maybe it could be very savant-like as well with something like that, as far 100%. As seeing things in such ways that others don't.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com. This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com. This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com. This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com. This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.